Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Bad news for California high school kids. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. For the first time in its history, the California State University system wants to cut future enrollment. Some 10,000 qualified high school graduates might not be admitted. Tonight, we'll hear about the latest response to budget problems in Sacramento. Also tonight, Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors go hat in hand to Washington. Will Democrats, Republicans, and the Bush White House bail out the failing auto industry? Or let Barack Obama pick up the pieces when he takes office? First, here's the news. We're on Ollie back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The big three automakers say they need big money to stay in business. We'll hear about the likelihood of a federal bailout tonight. First, this story. The California State University system has 23 campuses that have always been open to high school graduates who've done college prep work and earned a B average. That was then. This is now. For the first time in history, enrollment may be limited. Chancellor Charles Reed wants to cut next year's expected enrollment of 450,000 by 10,000. Allison Jones is Assistant Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. Mr. Jones, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk with you.
Delighted to have the opportunity to talk, but not delighted to have this kind of news. Why is it going to be necessary to cut the freshman class by 10,000?
In its most succinct way to describe it is California simply doesn't have the resources necessary to honor its commitment to fully fund the CSU to accommodate all eligible students. For the last 2 years, we have been serving more students than the state has been providing funding for, and we just simply can't continue to admit more and more students without receiving adequate funding because we cannot guarantee that they will get the classes, the sections, or the student support services they need in order to be successful.
What's the nature of that commitment? Is it a part of state law that all the kids who qualify are supposed to be admitted?
Actually, it is, but there are two parts to the state law. It's in the California State Education Code. It does require the state to ensure the adequate resources to support enrollment growth, as well as requiring the Budget Act to give us the appropriations necessary to accommodate all eligible students. In return, there is the expectation then that the CSU will admit and find a place within the system, not the campus's first choice, but within the system of all fully eligible students. In the absence of the adequate resources, that's the dilemma we find ourselves in. We just simply can't continue to enroll students for whom we're not receiving funding to support.
We're talking about the biggest system of its kind in the country, is that right?
That is correct. We have 450,000 students enrolled in the California State University. It's the largest in the United States.
Okay. How big would the freshman class be?
Typically, we enroll about 45 to 50,000 first-time freshmen and about 60 to 65 upper division transfers and lower division transfers in a particular academic year.
And you're looking to cut that by 10,000?
That's correct.
Now, there will be those who say this is a game of chicken with the state legislature trying to get which is now in session, talking about the budget.
Well, I think it's bringing to bear, of course, the need for the funding, but this is not a new discussion we've had with the governor or the legislature. The chancellor has been very clear for the last 2 years about the importance of having adequate funding. But we have to have authentic access. That is, we really, if we invite students in or admit them who are meeting the eligibility standards, then we have an obligation to provide to them the access to the classes and the sections and the support services. And we simply don't have that ability anymore.
This still has to be presented to a board of directors. If, in fact, it is approved, will any people who have already been accepted be denied?
Well, most, no, they would not be. Actually, the chancellor has the authority to take this action, but he wants the trustees tomorrow, the Board of Trustees, to have this public discussion because of the significant policy implications. As you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, this is the first time in the history of the state that the CSU has had to restrict access. We do have campuses that have been on a rolling basis admitting students since the 1st of October, but those students' admission would not be rescinded, provided that they fulfilled the obligation to complete the courses and work in progress.
What if the trustees don't want to do this? You say the chancellor has the authority. Can he do it in defiance of what the Board of Trustees wants?
I doubt very seriously that the chancellor would do that. If the trustees, for whatever reason in the discussion, said we should continue to admit all eligible students, the message it would send is we would admit the student, but we won't guarantee that you have classes. And this occurred back in the early 90s. When the state had merely its kind of first recession. We actually decreased enrollment over a two-year period, and it was largely by students who were admitted, attended, and enrolled, but couldn't get the classes, and ended up dropping out.
Wow. This is really draconian stuff.
It is a cultural change for the state of California, which historically has had a commitment to provide spaces for all fully eligible students, yes.
What about jacking up the fees?
That will be a conversation between the governor, the legislature, and the Board of Trustees. There has not yet been a discussion about fee increases, but I believe everything probably is on the table, and that likely is going to surface as part of the conversation.
Why not bring that up first before proposing to reduce the student enrollment?
Well, because fee increases further restrict access above and beyond. I guess it's a matter of balance and, first of all, to try to determine what the state is in the position to provide in terms of support. We need to understand first what the state is going to commit to understand how many students we can fund, and then it's going to be a discussion, as I say, with the governor, the legislature, and the trustees as to what fee increases, if any, might be necessary in order to ensure access.
What's the impact of this on the university system, the University of California, and the community college system?
It will have an impact. Whenever one system makes changes to its enrollment management policies, it has an impact. The University of California will likely see some students coming their way that can't get into the CSU, but the largest impact will probably be on the California community colleges on the part of first-time freshmen. We will, in fact, admit upper division transfer students who meet the requirements for admission at the transfer level, because if they continue to the community colleges, the work wouldn't count. They've reached the maximum number of units that they can really need to transfer. Also, I need to be sure the listeners are aware that we will continue by trustee policy to admit all local area students to the CSU campus that's local to them on the basis of system-wide admission criteria. That is, they will not be held to the higher admission standard, which would be dictated by an impaction process.
What about out-of-state students?
Out-of-state, our obligation by state law is always to California residents. The highest priority goes to California residents, first to upper division transfers, then to first-time freshmen, and it is really limited on that basis.
Could you just solve this problem by not having any more out-of-state students?
No. We have so few. As a system, the percentage of our enrollment from out-of-state and international students really is a very small percentage.
Some campuses are more desirable than others. As you said earlier, you can't guarantee which campus you get into. Are there still some campuses that don't have enough students?
There will be some campuses that will continue to have space available. In the local Los Angeles area, CSU Dominguez Hills, for instance, in Los Angeles, will probably continue to accept applications from first-time freshmen up to March 1st. But other campuses, such as Northridge, Fullerton, of course, is impacted, Long Beach State, Pomona, just to name a few, and Cal State Northridge are going to be hard-pressed to continue to accept applications beyond November 30th.
So the schedule now calls for Chancellor Reed to take this up with the trustees at their meeting tomorrow. Anything further than that, presumably, would involve the legislature and the governor.
That's correct.
Allison Jones, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Assistant Vice Chancellor, Academic Affairs for the California State University System. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Today's Los Angeles Times carried a full-page ad by the General Motors Acceptance Corporation headlined, "The Auto Industry Matters." It warns about the ripple effects if plants close and laid-off workers can't feed their families or pay taxes. Here's Alan Mulally, the CEO of Ford, on a morning talk show.
We're in an economic situation now with the credit crisis and the financial and the banking issues that we really, more than ever, the automobile industry needs to be part of the solution. And the only thing that we're asking for is to set up a bridge loan mechanism that if the economy continues to deteriorate in the near term, that we could access that so we can continue to invest in the products that people really do want and value and help be part of this economic recovery.
Mullally and the CEOs of GM and Chrysler testified on Capitol Hill today, along with auto workers president Ron Gettelfinger. David Shepherdson is based in Washington for the Detroit News. And David, thanks a lot for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What do you think of the prospects at this point of there being a bailout?
Well, look, clearly today there was a lot of opposition from both Democrats and Republicans about the current Democratic proposal, which is to take $25 billion from the Wall Street rescue package you were just talking about, the $700 billion, and divert it into this bridge loan program, as Al Mullally was talking about. The other alternative, which is what the White House wants to do, is convert the retooling program that was part of the CAFE increases, that $25 billion, drop the fuel efficiency requirements and turn that into basically a program where the automakers could use it to pay their bills as they face a very tough economy.
So those are the two proposals, and it does not appear that the twain will meet on those.
Well, exactly, because the way it works is, you know, the Republicans are supporting dropping the strings from the retooling money. A lot of Democrats want to use the TARP money. And at this point, there doesn't seem to be a good compromise between the two. The other thing is, you know, this is a lame duck session of Congress. They're only supposed to be here for a few days. It's very difficult to get anything done without overwhelming support. And I talked to Senator Feinstein earlier today, and she said she doesn't think that there are the 60 votes there to pass to end the filibuster and move to a vote on this.
Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California. What are the consequences, according to the auto companies, if they don't get the bailout before the end of the year?
Well, I mean, things are pretty dire for the automakers. GM and Ford lost or burned through $14 billion in cash in the third quarter in a three-month period combined. Each company was burning through more than $2 billion a month, one because of the dramatic decline in auto sales this year, but also because they've seen a rapid shift from smaller cars, from SUVs. And, of course, Detroit has made most of its money on SUVs and pickup trucks over the last 10 years.
And, of course, a lot of people say that's their own fault, that they didn't get ahead of the game like the Japanese manufacturers did and provide cars that are fuel efficient.
Well, I mean, there's no question that Detroit couldn't figure out how to make money on small cars. I mean, the average price of a Honda Civic versus a comparable American car is $5,000 or $6,000 more. I mean, Toyota and Honda have figured out how to sell people small cars and make money on it. And Detroit has largely made its profits from larger vehicles. And, you know, clearly, you know, as the market shifts towards small cars, Detroit has to figure out how to make more money and sell more small and mid-sized cars.
There are some that are saying that bankruptcy would be a better way to go than a bailout because it would force them to reorganize, perhaps get rid of some of the managers and go forward into the future.
I mean, I've heard that argument, but I do think the automakers make a strong argument, which is that people do buy an airline ticket from a bankrupt airline because they're only making a $300 investment that they're going to use up in the next few weeks. Will people buy a car when you have so many choices from a bankrupt company if you're worried about your warranty being honored, whether there will be spare parts, whether the company will be around to, you know, conduct recalls? So I do think it's a harder sell for a consumer to buy from a bankrupt company. Now, some have talked about some government overseeing, you know, sanctioned bankruptcy, you know, as one possibility. Clearly, they need to do restructuring, whether it comes more restructuring, whether it's in bankruptcy or out of bankruptcy, they have to take more difficult actions to return to profitability.
David Shepherdson, again, based in Washington for the Detroit News. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay. Harley Shaken is a professor at the University of California in Berkeley. He specializes in labor and the global economy. And Professor Shaken, welcome to you.
It's good to be here.
There was a bailout once before, the Chrysler bailout. Tell us what happened then.
Well, that happened in 1979, and in a lot of ways, the situation was quite similar for Chrysler. A sudden shift in the market, the company was the weakest of the automakers, and it began sliding very rapidly towards bankruptcy. In this case, there was a fierce debate in the Congress, but ultimately the Congress felt Chrysler was too large, to linked to the rest of the economy to let fail, and that the devastation in Michigan in general, Detroit in particular, would be astounding, costly in dollar terms, devastating in human terms. So the government authorized $1.5 billion in loan guarantees.
Sounds like peanuts these days.
Right. It does, but if you adjust it for inflation, it's still real money, just
okay.
Very small, rounding errors in our current environment. But the net result was they had 10 years to pay it off. They paid the loan off 7 years early, that is after 3 years. The government made about over $300 million on the deal, and Chrysler survived as a healthy company for a decade and a half later.
Did it survive as a healthy company, or was the inevitable postponed, as some people say?
No, not at all. Chrysler in the 80s gave us the minivan. Its models were selling very briskly. It was known as a very innovative company when it came to its engineering. What really began Chrysler's heavy downward slide is the so-called merger of equals in 1998 with the German company Daimler, that is the parent of Mercedes. That was more an acquisition than a merger, and Daimler essentially gutted Chrysler's engineering and made some very poor choices that led us, at least for Chrysler, where we are today.
One of the other big differences, of course, is the presence of the foreign automakers in this country, particularly in states like Alabama, where they are going away building cars with non-union shops. One of the senators, Republican senators, most opposed to any kind of bailout of the big three is Senator Shelby of Alabama. There's some conflicts of interest shaping up here?
Oh, sure. I mean, certainly Senator Shelby's ideology is very clear. No government role. But if you look a little closer, what he means is no government role to the competitors of Mercedes, Hyundai, and Honda, all of which have major operations in Alabama. The state of Alabama gave tens of millions of dollars, more than any of its competitors, to attract these companies. A Honda training center alone, the state funded for $30 million. That's a pretty significant government role. So the ideology is real, but it rings a bit hollow when you look at what took place on a state level in Alabama.
Really makes things very complicated. Again, Professor Harley Shaken is at the University of California in Berkeley. Darrell Samuelson is senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily. And Darren, thank you very much for being on our program.
Happy to be here.
One of the issues involved here has to do with the White House proposal, as we heard earlier, to convert $25 billion already appropriated by Congress to help the auto companies develop better fuel efficiency. Now the Republicans want, as I say, to convert that. What's your objection to that proposal?
Well, not so much an objection for me. I'm the reporter who's covering this.
Sure,
but
okay.
The objections that you're hearing, you know, are that this money shouldn't, you know, be directed, pulled out of the bigger financial bailout that Congress passed not too long ago. But, you know, the push here is to try and get these auto companies to try and, you know, produce cleaner, fuel efficient cars, meet the, you know, the fuel efficiency standards that were enacted into law in 2007. That's one of the things, at least from the environmentalist perspective, one of the groups that I'm covering. They would like to see the automakers, as they're getting this money, getting sort of restructured, they would like to see this money go toward, you know, meeting, you know, the first kind of changes in fuel economy in decades. And they'd also like to see them back down from some of their opposition they've had on greenhouse gas emission standards, whether it be California trying to implement its standards, which are some of the first in the nation to try and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or the efforts to try and create some national standards.
Thank you for clarifying your position. I didn't mean to suggest that you are an advocate for the people that you you have to report on. So if, in fact, this $25 billion were converted to just try to keep them in business, it would be sort of a free ride from the standpoint of the environmentalists who think that finally we have the leverage to get them to change their ways.
That's right. I mean, it took many, many years and many, many attempts to try and get the increase in corporate average fuel economy standards through enacted in a law that President Bush signed in 2008. It was the first real major energy push that the Democrats were able to accomplish probably one of the biggest accomplishments that you could say from the last Congress, or from the Congress that's wrapping up right now. So, you know, you have this big victory that the environmentalists had been pushing for, and, you know, it was a bipartisan coalition in some respects that got that bill across to the finish line eventually. So, they don't want to give on that, and, you know, they're hoping the domestic manufacturers can meet those standards.
Darren Samuelson with Environment and Energy Daily. Harley Shaken, back to you, Professor at UC Berkeley. What about the idea of using this crisis for the auto industry as an opportunity to change them, change the management, to change the fuel efficiency requirements, and make them more competitive, is the argument?
Oh, I think this crisis can serve exactly that role. In fact, the auto industry right now does get it. But this is a very difficult industry to turn around, given how capital intensive it is. All of the automakers are bringing out significantly more fuel-efficient cars next year, but all of them also have hybrids or plug-in hybrids in the works in the next 2 years. It's going to take a lot of money, and that those programs need to be accelerated. That will benefit all of us, and I think that's what's critical here. This is an opportunity for better fuel efficiency, for less carbon pollution out of the new vehicles, for the industry to do something that is really very belated, but the fact that it's engaged now is vital, I think, for the economy and for the environment.
Darren Samuelson, back to you. Another opportunity or possible opportunity, potential opportunity, is being seized by one of the Democrats, Henry Waxman of Los Angeles, to take over a chairmanship from John Dingell, who comes from Detroit, who's been very important in this industry. How does this battle within the Congress reflect the kinds of changes that might be going on in the auto industry?
It's pretty amazing. This is a battle that nobody really expected, you know, until the moment that, you know, Waxman announced his bid. And, you know, it came hours after Obama won the presidency. It was the Wednesday after the election. Some see it as a move by Waxman, the challenger, to really try and just get a shot across the bow on a whole front of issues, whether it be healthcare, which is another big issue that's in front of this committee, the auto industry, environmental regulations, energy regulations, and global warming. So, Henry Waxman really is just making a play for everything that is before this very, very important committee's jurisdiction.
But you've been told by Barney Frank, very important player in all of this, a Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, that one of the people who wants to push environmental fuel efficiency standards, that he's not going to vote for Henry Waxman. How come?
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of members. Barney Frank was someone I spoke with yesterday. Just in the last hour, I had a chance to talk to Charlie Rangel, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he's also voting for John Dingell. There's a whole host of reasons why John Dingell is getting support, and it's primarily, you know, he's the dean of the House of Representatives. He's been in Congress. He was just reelected for his 28th term, so 56 years. He's 82 years old. He's from Dearborn, Michigan. He represents sort of, you know, the history of this institution, and seniority rules in a lot of respects here in Congress. And, you know, to just bump somebody off in terms of seniority, at least for someone like Barney Frank or for someone like Charlie Rangel, who also have chairmanships, you start doing that, then I think that at least the very important senior members of Congress probably don't like the idea of other people nipping at their buds. So, you know, that's one thing that's going on here. And then there's an ideological issue, whether or not whoever wins this battle will be in charge pretty much of moving Obama's energy and environmental agendas forward on Capitol Hill in the House. And, you know, if it's Dingell does represent, I think, a more moderate perspective. He would probably be a little bit more of a coalition builder. He's very accomplished in doing legislation. For Henry Waxman, he's definitely seen as more of a liberal who would probably be pushing from the left. So, you know, you definitely have an ideological split here in terms of who wins this battle.
So, Professor Shaken, very quickly, we've only got 30 seconds left. A lot of complexities in this that have to do with much more than just the automobile industry.
Absolutely. What we're talking about is the state of the economy, and the impact of failure here would have on employment and economic health. Voting no on this, in effect, is an anti-stimulus package when it comes to the economy.
Well, Harley Shaken, thanks very much to you. Professor at UC Berkeley, Darren Samuelson at Environment and Energy Daily, thanks to you as well. And thanks to our earlier guest, David Shepherdson of the Detroit News. Which Way LA, produced tonight by Katie Cooper and Gary Scott, our managing producers, Karen Radziner, technical director, Mike Newport. You can email us at kcrw.com/whichwayLA, and you can share your comments at that same address, kcrw.com/whichwayLA. I'm Marvin Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.